Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner and we've got a really special episode for you today. I am joined by Zach Weiss. Hello, Zach.
Hello, Blake.
We're also joined by James Helms. James, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, everybody.
And we are also delighted to be joined by Mitchell Wine of Marathon Watches. Mitchell, thank you for joining us and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on your podcast. Actually, you know what? It's a good concept to have a podcast. As soon as podcasts came out, I started downloading them and listening to them on different things. But it's really great to be able to walk your dog or just sit outside and listen to a podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah, I find podcasts kind of relaxing. It's kind of
me too. I listen when I walk into work. Yeah. Because you can be doing other things while you listen.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Of course, you could be doing other things while you listen. It's interesting. Yeah. Sometimes you can break it up with music.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And of course, he won't in this case.
Before we get into Marathon, which I'll let you talk about, it's customary around here to do a wrist check. So let's start with you. Mitchell, what are you wearing on your wrist?
I'm wearing, it's a good thing I wore a significant watch today. I'm wearing the new Dive Auto with the Arctic White dial.
Very nice.
Very cool. Okay.
And that's the 41 millimeter?
Yeah. It took a while to do, and I know a lot of enthusiasts wanted it. Because we started with the 026 dial, which is a smaller medium size. This is a large size, but we only made 100 pieces of these so far. It's taking a lot longer to make them. I know we're in production of another 100, but it's nice. You see that?
Yeah, very cool.
And actually, you know what? The brilliance of the white dial is so brilliant that it reflects into the tritium tubes and makes it reflect in daytime as well.
There you go.
That's cool.
Huh? You can actually see it reflecting in the daytime because there's phosphorus activation in those tubes.
Very cool.
I knew it'd be nice. I always wanted to do it because working in daylight as opposed to working at nighttime like other people, I find it's easier to see black on a white dial. But this really stands out. And I'm glad I did it for personal reasons. And I know a lot of people who work in the Arctic are happy about this too.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Excellent.
James, what are you wearing? You wearing a marathon?
Actually, not today. I gave my marathon away a little while ago because I'm actually going to be getting another one pretty soon. But today I have a khaki field mechanical on from Hamilton.
Okay.
Oh, nice. How old is it?
This one is about a year and a half old. I have the Earth PVD style one. Here, I'll show it to you in the camera. But nice. This particular watch, it's this one that I really can't take off. I like it quite
Very
a bit.
Cool.
Do you have a date on it?
This is the one without the date. Yep. This is the smaller version with just it's the hand crank model. And, but they have so many different kinds now that you can really get it at whatever flavor, size, date you want now.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. We use the same movements, the 2801 17 jewel. It's a standard. It's been like that for 30 years, that movement.
Tried and true, workhorse, all those things, right?
Everyone. Yeah.
Zach Weiss, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a watch you're familiar with because I think you're wearing the same thing in a slightly different color. But we are rocking marathons today. I got my Navigator on in the desert tan kind of color, personal favorite.
With a desert tan
with a matching, almost tonal, exact matching strap from Havison Brand in the UK. I couldn't resist the full tan effect here. I'm a big fan of that. I love about this
that's
is that you
great
can't.
Effect. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, it looks nice.
It's a good combo.
You know, I love this because you can't get a case color like this unless you go up to like an IWC Mojave, which is tens of thousands of dollars, which I'm not buying. And I really, really like alternative to steel cases or just black cases. So this is a really nice change of pace for that. And for me, that's why I like to wear it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wearing the Sage
yeah.
I believe, right? And I have it on a matte crown and buckle strap that's like this khaki color that I think has a nice contrast to it as well. These are really fun watches to wear. They're really easy to wear. They're very light on the wrist. These are composite cases. Yes.
Yeah, they're fiber shell. It's actually a very high grade type of extrusion plastic, and the reason why we started producing it, and that was because we were able to save the U.S. federal government, when they had big contracts, a lot of money. And also the fact is they had to transfer overseas to the Middle East shipments of 5,000 watches at a time. And can you imagine the difference in weight of plastic to metal in cases.
Yeah.
Try to lighten the load. When someone's issued a their uniform and everything, shoes and everything, the watch, I mean, every bit of weight counts.
When did they first become composite?
You know what? The general purpose, well, quite obviously, the general purpose mechanical, which originates from a GGWW spec, but it was always in steel. Plastics didn't evolve. I remember my dad doing actually the first plastic, I think it was in 1980 around then. Yeah, I think it was around 1980.
So that brings up a good point. Maybe we can start there. You are a part of a lineage that has owned this brand for four generations. Is that correct?
That's true. But it's actually, I'm the third generation in Marathon Watch. My grandfather started Marathon Watch. My grandfather's eldest brother started Wienstrom Watch around 1904, I think. I can't remember. With my great-grandfather. So remember, in those days, really everything was a pocket watch. And I think my grandfather's eldest brother, it was a big family, Alex, felt that once wristwatches came into play and was easier to produce them, he saw the next iPhone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because remember, people in those days didn't have, every person didn't have a watch, but my great-uncle Alex had this vision that it's going to come down in price more and more, and he's going to be able to really, with the wrist, a smaller movement, making a wrist watch, they could sell a lot of watches, which they did. They manufactured a lot of watches. So, yeah. So I grew up in the watch business.
Yeah, literally, right? You've been steeped in it.
It was, you know, I think about it a lot because a lot of people talk to me about that question. And I think as a little boy, I always felt that I might, in my head, get, I guess this is what I have to do. I'm going to end up in this thing. I really wanted to be a fireman when I was 5 years old to 9 years old, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't good at hockey. And, you know, I went through phases and ended up with a degree in economics and then moved to Ottawa to escape everything. And, studied psychology at Carleton. I went into the business and I felt that what I learned in university and also what I learned from all my friends and different people I've met throughout my life, because my dad was quite smart about it, introducing me always to whoever was important to the business, even as a child. And I saw the way he ran the business. And so that, in actuality, I might have gone to university or, you know, and worked at the children's hospital for a little stint and do different things. But what I really learned was from being my father, with my father, my grandfather. My grandfather used to make me strap watches when I was around. He used to make me put the pins in the leather straps when I was around 5 or 6 years old. And I used to get a comic book at the end. And then I started strapping watches. They used to bring it home, you know, on Saturdays. And I'd sit in front, watch cartoons and strap watches. I mean, in those days, a lot of our stuff wasn't military and it wasn't, you know, to the grade that we do now. Few were, but the military ones, you know, were done in factory, but the ones we sold to many corporations such as the Hudson's Bay Corporation or the Morgan's or Eaton's, you know, which are Canadian department stores, were a bit different.
So when you got out of university, did you hesitate about going back into the business, or was it something you always knew you were going to do?
You know what? I wanted to go ahead. I saw there was an opportunity right away at modernizing the company because computers were just coming out. I graduated in 86, which was a weird time to graduate because it was really only my last year that we started doing computer programming. But I did a lot of that in COBOL and Fortran, and I learned about organization and how electronics and, you know, modern machinery could really help a corporation. And when I went in, I computerized our inventory system. It was hard to do from all these binder documents, but I think I got addicted to the process, and I got addicted to making something for people that actually use the product. And what I liked about working for my dad is we always met really the customers. My dad brought me down to Richmond and I met the engineers, or I was in Ottawa and I met the engineering department of national defense. And, you know, my dad actually did quite a bit of diplomatic work between Canada and other countries, being who he was. And I learned how to ask the right questions and to pay attention to what people say, especially people of importance or decision-making things. I mean, I learned a lot, let's say, from the Canadian Department of Defense when we did our when we did our pool tests, you know, when a strap would rip off your watch. You don't want to actually end up on a turret swinging from a strap that can't actually pull off. It's nice to have lugs, but they have to break at some point. So it's like I've met so many people that taught me so many different things. And I think it's been a great experience. And we were just on the phone. If I'm talking too much, just tell me.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Please keep going. Yeah.
So I was just on the phone, you know, speaking to my assistant who actually, you know, he's right there for me and he tells me the way it is. He's good. And our sales director was supposed to be on this call, but I didn't forward them the meeting, but that's okay. It's funny because what we've made is a corporation. We're a Canadian company, but we put our Canadian ethics in the company. I'm very proud of it. You know, with this COVID situation, I never realized how there are so many companies which keep their employees part-time so they don't have to pay benefits. And they know, big corporations know that these people do deserve full time, but they don't want to do the benefits or give someone a day off to get a COVID vaccine or, you know, help people when they're sick. But really what I've learned is my father always treated everyone like family and I do the same thing. My father's still alive and my father always asks and speaks to different people in the office to see how they are truly, because we work together and we're like family and we take care of each other. And I personally made sure that it doesn't matter whether you work in the corporate offices or in the warehouse or an assembly, you deserve benefits and you deserve to be taken care of because you're part of the family. And I think by that work ethic and having such happy staff has really made the company we are. I mean, really, you care about each other and we watch out for each other and we work in teams. You know, not everybody could have their up days, so we have to accommodate. And I think that's basically why Marathon's such a good company, and that's why we make such good products.
That's great to hear. You know, I mean, there's always that kind of personal touch I think you get from like an independent, family-run kind of like small organization, which I think you kind of feel in the product in the end of the day, you know, that I think we all pick up on kind of as consumers. But not to divert from there, but like, I'm just curious, actually, what is the size of Marathon? Like, how many employees do you have? I know you're in Canada, but then you also have manufacturing in Switzerland. Just tell me about the reach of the brand. It's kind of fascinating.
Well, I think we're considered a small to medium-sized business. I think we have between 50 to 60 employees in Canada. And then we have our own laboratory in the United States specifically to test our products before distribution to any customers. So we do the final inspection in accordance with the NRC. We have our own NRC lab and we test all watches. We have to, and we've actually never had a failure, so it's good. But we have to by law, and I think it's a good thing. And we have our factory in Switzerland, which employs in Le Chaux-de-Fonds altogether, I would say not only in our factory, but subcontractors such as dial makers, maybe around 15 people could be. And not everything's automated. Some of our machines are automated. We have a stem cutting machine, and that's pretty new. That's only 40 years old. We're getting a new one. We just got, you know what? What's a good thing is when you buy machinery 50 years ago and it still works in the watch industry.
That's very cool.
This is an investment in buying good equipment and good Swiss equipment.
Yeah.
What happens is a lot of design and is the actual motor work that we do in Switzerland, meaning making sure that the movements we receive from the movement manufacturer that makes our movements, such as our M2 movement, which is the equivalent of a 2824 SW200, but it's an SW200 that's, as they say, elaboré. And what we do is we have special testing on every single watch, as well as every watch gets adjusted for timing at an increased level than a standard movement. And we do this at all different angles. And actually, I had a sheet showing the different angles, but I don't have it to show you because I'm not in my office. I'm at home right now.
Well, I wanted to ask, Mitchell, so, you know, in the history of marathon, I find quite fascinating. But one of the things that is the most interesting to me about marathon is that I feel that it's more, you're probably one of the most purpose-built, if not the most purpose-built watches still in existence. You know, a lot of watches have kind of changed from their original intended purpose and now are a style or a luxury item.
I know.
When you look at the watches that you make now and you look at the family and where you've come from, what was everybody into before you and before the very functional watches? Did you have any offshoots of luxury items, or were you always just a purpose-built watch company?
We private labeled a few jewelry brands in Canada. That's true. But it was always using Inca block movements. In the days of before my father, and I guess when my father was younger, they had their brother, Monia, who lived outside of Geneva, used to organize with different watch factories, such as Basis Watch or different watch families, and used to organize the production of either movements to be sent to Canada for us to assemble in our own offices or full watches, depending on what it was. If it was a green gold case from Germany, it really did have high value. And so they used to put in special, you know, the new Inca block in those days and whatever features they could improve the movements that they were buying either from Valjoux or BFG or other manufacturers. Because remember, in those days, there was many manufacturers of movements. And in the crisis, a lot of these little nice companies either closed and tooling was lost, or ETA, the Swatch Group, bought them up. Back to being purpose-built, my father always, we always had another brand, different brands of watches, which were for the consumer, but we always supplied the Canadian government with specific stopwatches, torpedo timers, and we supplied the U.S. government with, I remember, these special 12-hour timers that only we had the movements, and thank goodness we did. You know, when the crisis was happening, we were very fortunate to see that we have to have mechanical movements. It doesn't matter if quartz movements are coming out. A quartz movement with a magnetic field is going to collapse a watch. So we needed those mechanical movements, and we're praying to God that nobody stops production, but they all did. But out of the crisis came a monopoly, and now the monopoly is broken. So we have great watchmakers. That's the good thing. We have fantastic watchmakers in Marathon Watch in our factory, Jean-Maurice Huguenin, who I have a long history with. And now we're developing new stopwatch movements. We're going to improve a few different movements that we already have designs for and adapt the SW200 to even be a higher tolerance. Our history with Mr. Garcia from Switzerland goes back, him and I go back, I think maybe 30 years when Alita was an unknown name. But you have to realize, guys, that we are from Chaudfond. Marathon Watch is a Chaudfonnier company, which is a French-Swiss company. And the Swiss watchmaking industry in Gränchen or in the German part is different than it is in the French part. First of all, we only speak French. We don't really know how to speak German, so it's hard to communicate. But now people do know English. But our town is made of a lot of small component manufacturers. And you know what? Almost from every series of anything, something's wrong with one component and you have to run down the street and have the foot changed on the dial, or realize that we used Arctic white paint instead of another type of paint, or the wrong. We had a big issue. We once issued a new, I think, Marigold edition of watches with, you know, the warning, the tritium warning on the dial. Accident. So try to catch everything.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of something I just wanted to ask you, you know, because you're one of the few brands that use tritium gas tubes. And, you know, obviously the watch industry has this long history of using like radioactive materials that has been, you know, since the 90s converted to superluminovas and non-radioactive. But you have continued to use these vials. And I'm just curious, like, what is it like to use those? How do you work with those? Because obviously there has to be some safety standards there. But then, you know, I'm also just interested in the... clearly there's a demand for it, which must also come from the military. I don't know, just a very interesting kind of aspect of the business is the continued use of the tritium gas. I just wonder if you could go into that.
Yeah, and quite simply why that instead of like what everyone else does with the, like there's a purpose that you guys use them, obviously.
There is a purpose. First of all, before tritium gas was used, we used to paint tritium actually on the dials. And basically, there were three companies who supplied the U.S. government with wristwatches when I was younger. And that was my dad, Hamilton Watch, and Stalker Neil, which doesn't exist anymore. Hamilton got taken over by the Swatch Group, and they bought the brand. And I think they're doing a fantastic job at it. But in those days, I'll try to simplify it because it's sort of a bit chemistry. So when you have a liquid and you have a molecule of tritium in that liquid, in that paint, in that polymer that you're painting on a dial, only 1/10 or maybe 1/15 of that molecule that's sitting on the surface of the paint is going to be exposed. So you have to use a lot more tritium to mix a lot of tritium with the pigment. So you end up having like 50 or 60 millicuries in a watch, could be 100 millicuries. And it's very hard to control. It's really hard to control, even with screen printing. So there was a technology for tritium tubes that was actually developed, I think, by Saunders and Rowe in England. I remember I actually wrote an essay on this years ago for a Japanese customer. And what happened was, they figured that they could light up dials in airplanes by putting big tubes filled with tritium gas. It was able to illuminate a map. And what the Canadian government really needed were to light up landing strips where we had no electricity. So in our Canadian Arctic, what happened, what we needed, remember, we could only get in certain times of the year for some communities to transport merchandise or bring someone sick back, but we have to be able to land an airplane. And what they did was in Chalk River, Saunders and Rowe opened up a plant and they used to make special lights, light sources filled with tritium gas. And those are tubes of tritium gas. And they put them in the landing field. And then the airplanes would know where to land. I think it was sticking up in a stick, like in a frame.
That's fascinating.
So that was sort of like having a light bulb, but it didn't need electricity. And don't forget, so how a tritium, I'll tell you the formula. It's really easy how to make tritium tubes for watches, if you think about it. A long tube comes from Corning. It spritz it inside with phosphorus, which is, you know, sort of, it's a safe substance, but it lights up upon energizing. And they spray in a vacuum tritium gas, just a little bit of tritium gas, and that tritium gas activates the phosphor to give light. So really it's the activation of tritium and phosphor. So with Marigold, with Luminova and other non-radioactive painting, you'll have a high energy upon light activation for about an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, but once you get past that, it starts to diminish greatly. And in 8 hours, you have a diminished dial. With tritium tubes, you actually have an even glow at all times. It's a lower luminosity, but it's even. And let's say you have soldiers in a dark cave without any light that are just sitting and waiting to jump out for an attack in some far region of the world, they could actually see their watches very well, as you know, could be attested by a lot of our customers. And a lot of our customers work in really dark environments, and that tritium tube is very crucial in their job. Mm-hmm. So that's the story.
No, that's great. That's, yeah, that was fascinating to hear, especially the landing strip. That makes so much sense. I never thought about that. But I mean, you know.
Yeah, so it's made of tries for the watches.
I've never.
But it costs a lot to make.
Yeah, I'm sure. But, no, I've never had to hang out in a dark cave, but I always appreciate how once your eyes adjust to the darkness of just like a dim room or a movie theater or something like that, how you can, a quick glance, I mean, there's nothing compares to tritium tube. I mean, it's fun to light up a diver with tons of loom, but like you're saying, in an actual real life situation, you know, this is functionally better. So
yeah. And it's like, it's good. It's these small things that make a big difference here. And I think it's easy to think about when you think about watches that are built for the military or high performance. In your head, you kind of picture this, you know, some big watch bristling with all kinds of functions and complications and all that. But these are, at their base, just like very simple, but the small details are just done right. Like, right, those the little details matter here, every single one of them, in these situations, I can imagine.
You know what? I'm really appreciative that you say that, Blake, because you know what? I'm always doing the small details, and I know I drive a lot of people crazy, and they're probably going to listen to this podcast and say, no way, like, you know, they know I do, but it's those details. It's those little details that are so important when you make a device, even a screwdriver. It's that detail that, you know, it's not going to burr at the end of the screwdriver or you're going to harden it. Like, it's so important that we use screws instead of pins for our bracelet. Because you have to be able to adjust it and not destroy it or replace the screw. You have to be able to replace the screw. You don't want to damage the watch and you want it strong enough.
How much feedback do you get from customers in the field using these things in maybe intense situations? And do you on a yearly basis review all this feedback and then take into consideration how this is going to change the next generation of your products? Or what's that process like?
No, you know what? We listen to all the feedback and we just, honestly, we do have loads and loads of letters telling us about situations or emails. And, you know, we're just really getting to know social media and start. We have social media in our company and we're learning a lot from our customers about, you know, and they let us know. I like it that we have enthusiasts that say what they feel. But, you know, for many years, it actually did influence us from our design point. I mean, the search and rescue watch, if I didn't speak to soldiers out east in Halifax or to enforcement officers, or I wouldn't know exactly how to make the torque on the turning bezel or how to slot it so it fit their gloves. So, and as well, we wouldn't have done a white dial if people who were actually some people at D&D who felt that, you know, you should make one white for bright light situations. You know, there's people that need it. And some people prefer white. And as long as the tubes glow, they'll always see the timer day and night. But of course, you know, in accordance with military specifications from what I've read from the 1930s on, the dial should always be black and the printing should be white because it's much easier to read white on a black background than black on a white background. Black and white background. It is easier if the size of the lettering and everything remains the same on average, especially in a dark atmosphere. And that's the big fear. When you're in the dark, your timing seems to have to be more and more correct.
So you alluded earlier to testing that you have to do, for instance, when the strap would break away. What other kind of tests are these subjected to that might surprise customers out there?
So who designs those tests? Is that something that you do in accordance with the DoD?
There's tests that involve the watch complete and tests that involve the movement. But all in all, the motor of the watches, the movements. And so we have to make sure that when we subject the final product, that it's tested to completion. So one of the major tests that we do is, I know other manufacturers do this. I mean, Cartier does this. They're really good at quality control. But we would vibrate in three different directions for 20 minutes in each direction at a certain amount of hertz. Because if there's anything loose in that movement, it's going to come apart. We're going to find it. There's also the heat test. Now, it's not that. You have to realize that when we do a heat test for 24 hours and check the timing after it's done and during the heat test, whether it goes fast or not, people are saying, well, your watch is never going to get that hot, or your watch is never going to get to minus 40. But a watch is delivered for military purposes and will be perhaps sitting in a hot desert with boxes getting really hot, or a cargo ship that's in it has a container that's boiling away and your watch is in there. We don't want to have it fall apart. It's a military shipment. And we don't want to, when things are dropped in the north as supplies for the Canadian Rangers, it could very presumably be exposed to such cold extremes. The watch has to be able to tell time. And do you know what's interesting? So, not last summer, but the summer before, just before COVID hit suddenly, we were reviewing our testing protocol. And there's a very good laboratory in our same town, which a lot of people use, called Laboratoire Dubois. And I was looking at different performance specifications that we did with them and what we do for our testing and what percentages are required to get a good probable result. So if you test one watch out of 1,000, the probability of you getting a lot of defects that are not caught is pretty bad. But as long as you use probability charts and test every single watch, you have no problem. So I was looking at, we conformed to both the Canadian and American 46374, the specification for testing called out in that. But there's two levels of testing, and we usually go to level number one, which is a higher level of testing. We test actually, we don't test each watch to destruction, or else we'd have no watches to sell. But we test to destruction a higher than required quantity. And we also test every single watch in accordance with the specification 46374. And that's it. And what we do, you know what? We actually have a 2-year warranty. And you know what? I speak to people all the time who have a 20-year-old marathon watch, and really it does, they work. I mean, you may have to get it re-oiled in 20 years or 10 years, but the oils are so good. These, what we use now, you know, there's fantastic oils from Mobius, I think it is. And they don't dehydrate, so they don't gum up. So really, you know what? I think our word is our bond, and we stand by our product. We stand by our product. If there is a problem, there is no problem, because if you have a problem with our watch, something's wrong, and let's get it fixed for you. I mean, if you drove over it with a truck a few times and the timing was off or the case is scratched, well, what can I tell you? If you drove a car off a lot and smashed up, the car manufacturer won't be changing the car for you, you know what I mean? But we're very reasonable, and this happens. And we'll take the scratches out of your case and realign your turning bezel, no problem.
Have you ever come across a test that you were about to put one of your watches in and thought, oh shit, there's no way this watch is going to live through this? Do you ever get nervous about some of the some of the new tests, procedures that are put into these things?
You know what? There was one I thought for sure, and I thought my father was going to kill me, because we took on an endeavor of making a clock, a submarine clock. And I really didn't do the I was young and I really didn't do the costing that well. So the mold costing I got down. We made the molds. I think it's a company called US Plastics in Buffalo. So we manufactured our cases in Buffalo, New York. It's a company that supplied the car industry and did everything. But the problem was the lens, getting the lens right. And I thought I could use a certain type of plastic, but it would scratch. So I spoke to someone at 3M and they supplied a new type of plastic that was scratch resistant. And then I realized, my father didn't realize, and I don't think I realized, that there's a special type of testing that needed to be done. It was a type of QPL testing. And part of the QPL testing was an impact test. And the impact test was so severe, there was no way that our clock could survive it or anything. It was an MIT or one university that had this pendulum swing. We had the lab we were using at the time, which was probably City Testing Labs in New Jersey. They had to contract it out to a university to do the pendulum swing. They stuck the clock to the pendulum and the clock went sweeping around and hit a cement wall. And that's the impact test.
Yeah.
But you know what? It passed.
No kidding.
The clock didn't make it, and I didn't realize it. It didn't matter if the clock makes it or not with such an impact or such an explosion. What they want to make sure is in a submarine that if by a change in pressure or impact, this thing won't go flying off the wall and hurt someone. Mm. You don't need things flying around in the submarine.
I would imagine that, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, one of the best vacations I ever took was actually a tour at Pearl Harbor. Were you ever at Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I've been there. I've been there as a kid.
Really? Wow.
You have to see the submarines. None of those submarines, those are World War II series submarines, and I can't remember the series, but there's a lot of product in there on the clocks, Chelsea Clock Company, and how everything is bolted to the walls. And
do you ever get harrowing stories from your customers that are in intense situations and the watch came through for them in a certain kind of way? Maybe they're waiting in a cave to do an attack or something, and then they can see the trading tooth. Or do you get feedback from real world situations that make you think, well, I'm really proud of this watch?
Actually, we do. It's nice to hear that, There was a story recently, somebody actually, a shrapnel hit the watch, but didn't hit them. It deflected off. So there's a lot of stories. There's a lot of stories where our watch came through. I think it's also comfortable. You know what? It's funny. A watch is sort of a person's comfort. Imagine that, your dad was in Vietnam and you got his watch and you have those memories of your dad. And, the feeling of, your dad wore this through his life or when he worked. It was a tool that he depended on. And, this tool is passed on to you. So I think that there's a lot of history with every single watch. I think that me, myself, I know the watch I was wearing at certain occasions or I have a special watch I wear. Actually, it's around 30 years old. It's one of our first field watches, but that's the watch I wear when I'm gardening or doing stuff that I could really smash up, and it's covered with paint. But
the best kind, yeah.
The lucky person gets that watch.
No, that's great. That's great. So I wanted to ask just about the this composite material that you're using and how long it took to develop that. What was that process like? Did it go through? Did you think you had this is perfect. And then it's just not going to,
Why?
Yeah, why?
I'll tell you what, it took a process because actually originally they had to carve it out and we had to screw the back onto the front. So what you're looking at is maybe a fifth or sixth revision of our composite field watch. Originally, so I found the original 10 or 20 pieces that were sent to the lab for testing for getting it approved, the new case. And the cases, The plastic in the original testing was shiny. It was like polished plastic, and it was screwed on. But when we finally did do the first production, my father thought that, and he was right, he could save the U.S. government a lot of money in the Persian Gulf War contracts by, instead of having a separate back and a front, we could seal and protect the movement even better if we did a case with a drop-in movement. So the case was sealed. The serial numbers were actually they were milled out in the mold. And when it was injected, out came out the serial numbers and all the important information for the ordering section of the U.S. government. And they drop in the movement. And then what you do is you lock it from the bottom with a pin and put in the stem, and that locks the movement in place. And the pressure seal from the plexi crystal and the O-rings and the metal inside holding ring and the movement ring would lock into place. And that would be how the watches were made. We're able to produce 5,000 a week in those days because it was smart of my dad. What he did was he simplified production. But remember, in those days, a lot of watches that were required by different governments were considered disposable because they knew that they only needed to last 2 years or 2 to 5 years, and it would be disposed of as you would someone's boots when they left the government. It's like the uniform doesn't get reused. Of course, as we know, a lot of people who bought used equipment benefited from buying used products from soldiers. But I think it's hard to find Marathon collectible or Hamilton collectible stuff from that era. But I think it's a good history of watchmaking, how we did things in those days, how we thought. But now what we do is we changed our design because materials became better. So, you know, life gets better. Like, you know, there's better treatments for cancer these days. Well, guess what? There's better ways of making a crystal and cheaper ways. I mean, in the olden days, to make a sapphire crystal would cost around $200, $300. But now we use synthetic sapphire, which is very cheap to produce. Well, it's not cheap to produce. It's very expensive to produce. But we realize by using a sapphire crystal, we're improving the watch. We're improving the way you could see the dial. There's no refraction. You could have more of an open dial, and it's scratch resistant. And that really makes it a more solid watch. And by using stainless steel backs that snap on, it's easy to service the movement, because what we feel is we don't make watches that are disposable anymore. That's not us. We're not working so hard to make a watch that you should throw in the garbage. I think even if the government has, oh, it should be a disposable watch, which they would never do, we would give them a watch that's solid, and hopefully someone can enjoy it for many, many years and pass it on mm-hmm. to their children.
How often do the mil specs themselves change, particularly in terms of the design? Because, you know, I know
it depends on the government.
Okay, interesting.
It depends on the agenda of the government in place, to be honest with you.
That's interesting. Because this, you know, I have the Navigator on, and I, you know, I don't know this exact mil spec, but I know variations of this go all the way back to the 60s, right? Like the late 60s, the sort of case design.
You're right about that. There's a whole story about that Navigator watch. Right. We could either do it now, or you could leave it for another podcast.
Oh, let's have it. Let's have it.
A real good story. My dad developed the Navigator based on requirements of making an electric watch for pilots. And that original specification had nothing to do with the general 46374 spec. But in the 1990s, Picatinny Arsenal wanted to incorporate the standalone U.S. Air Force spec into the general military spec. So what the U.S. government wanted to do was consolidate all the watch specs into one spec. Mm. And we're damn lucky that we were around before then, because you know what? The original spec is really the essence of the Navigator watch. And if it wasn't for some engineers taking the time, making the testing requirements and understanding what the reason why this watch is made, make it right. So what's important is when we develop a watch, we have to know why. What are you using the watch for? You can't just, our watches are tools and they have a purpose. So the purpose of this watch was to allow for pilots that flew the new F-14 in those days, I think it was, and a lot of parachutists that if they had extreme pressure changes through ejection, or they didn't, first of all, they wanted the watch to have the ability of timing as well as two time zones, which worked as a cheap GMT watch, but also that the lens won't fly out and hurt the person in the face upon ejection. And my dad worked with, I remember in those days, Jean-Marie Huguenin, and my father's friend who was Galet. We bought all the parts and they assembled those for us. But the main thing was that the Hessellite lens was bendable and it had a lip shape, like a U with a curve at the end, and it fit underneath. So it could bend, but not explode, not come out. You know, with a dive watch, you're always concerned about the compression. By altitudes, you're worried about, you know, the vacuum. The
opposite. Yeah.
So that's why we do a vacuum test on the navigation watches for 35,000 feet. You know, not many pilots.
The amount of testing that you have in that is amazing.
I know. You just want to know something. The test isn't that. It's not that hard to do. It's just a vacuum test, a special vacuum chamber, and you put the watch in that simulates 35,000 feet.
Could we build one in our office here and start testing every watch?
Watches explode?
That we review
the explode test.
This watch. Be careful in flight with this; it will explode. Yeah.
So, Mitchell, we were talking. I guess it was a few months ago now. Zach and I have taken a particular interest, and maybe you have too, Blake. I'm sorry to leave you out, but Zach and I have had a lot of conversations about clocks in the last year. And we had an interesting conversation with you a few months back, and I wanted to kind of revive that, because as with most things, when we go to Marathon and ask a little bit more about them, you've been doing it for decades. So we were interested because we started to look at your clock range, because we had a couple in the office and we've used them, and they had automatic illumination and they had a lot of different dial styles, and we had some of the larger studio clocks. And then we started to dig further, and you started to tell us that you, in particular, you personally are actually involved in every part of the clock manufacturing process. Like, it's not an off the shelf item. I don't know if you're testing them the same way, but what's the lineage of that?
No, we don't test the same as watches. Well, the movements we don't design. The movements we analyze and we'll say, make this in brass instead, or different, you know, circuitry. We design the ICs that are for our digital clocks, depending on what the customer is using it for or where the customer actually lives. So sometimes we have clocks with special ice alerts. Remote ice alerts. We have special clocks that will remotely tell you the temperature in a freezer or in a fridge with a special probe. So you could keep pharmaceuticals at certain extreme cold temperatures, and an alarm will go off if it goes above a certain temperature, you can set it, or alarm will go off if it goes below. So as long as it stays within range, the alarm won't go off. The alarm goes off, you might as well throw out whatever is in the fridge because your fridge just broke down. Not true, but I think in some pharmaceuticals that would be applicable. I do design the clocks because I actually like design very much, and I've grown up with a family of people that design things, and I was taught from a young age, if you're in a restaurant, you're doing design on a. Do you ever go to a restaurant where they have a paper cloth on the table? So my friend Mr. Dreyfus, who actually own Rotary Watch in Switzerland, which is a family business as well. He actually became our first administrator of the company in Switzerland. And he said to me, Mitchell, whenever you do drawings on a tablecloth, you take that with you because someone from another watch company is going to sit at the same table and copy your design, which is true. In our town, there's so many watch factories. You have to watch what you do and watch what you speak because people talk. It's a small town. Everybody's in the watch business. It's
interesting. So this should be a show on Bravo pretty soon.
Yeah.
As far as those clocks go, I mean, when did that start? When did you start making clocks as Marathon?
Clocks were always a mainstay of Marathon. I think more from my dad's, my dad in the 60s really came up with fabulous designs for, we supplied major chain stores such as in Canada, we had the Woolworth Woolco chain, we had the Simpsons, we had Eaton's, and he had great colors. And most of our clocks in those days were made in Germany. There was just one clock we made for ships, and I remember that. And I'm hoping, you see, we moved to new premise, and I'm hoping that this year maybe we're going to unpack more and find more treasures because we're finding so much crap all the time. But there are these clocks my dad used to do out of, it was so heavy, even as a child, he used to lift them. It was on a wood board, and it was metal, and you'd have a key to close it. But that movement, was from Germany, and that movement, you had to wind up fully and it would last 8 days. And it was an 8-day movement. But hey, we have a long history of making clocks. And I think that it's very important to see the time wherever you are when you're taking a pulse of a patient, whether you're working at an office in GSA headquarters in New York, or you're working at the Department of Agriculture, or you're working at a lab. For blood, you should know the time. And what's important is if you're doing a lot of government work or stats work, you should really have the time, the date in front of you. And if you're in a lab, you should have the temperature and humidity because, you know, when you do a lab report, you have to put the specifics that the testing procedure was done at this temperature, this relative humidity over this period of time. And this was the low and this was the high. You know, so I like our clocks because they're a tool. And what we did was, we evolved the auto light sensor technology into our clocks by using LED backlighting. And when you go into a patient's room and you have a Marathon, the big 057 clock like they use in the newsrooms, there's a backlight. So you don't have to turn on the light in the room to check someone's pulse. You could just see it, and our red hand is visible enough. And we also do the minute counter. So we have three levels of dial in there. So that dial actually was based on a field watch design, also with taking someone's pulse in red. So I made that standard stand out.
I love that backstory. I wouldn't have thought of that, but that's such a great, reason beyond just, you know, general, make it more visible, that there's this, you know, very specific, but very, you know, smart, like, problem you're trying to solve. This is very cool. I also just like...
You know what else we did? You know what was great about this clock? I'll tell you what. And this is where we work so hard and we develop stuff for the military. So with our chronometers that are in naval ships, you have to have used three in sequence, but every year you have to change the batteries in these devices. What we did was, so we don't lose time, it's so accurate, you don't want to have to set the time again when you change the battery. What we did was we put it in a capacitor next to the movement. We used to have a dual circuit battery. So you take out one battery, replace it, and then change the other battery so the movement would never stop. And we used to wire it. And Jean Maurice came up with that idea. And God love him. You know what? To be honest with you, every single clock we used to produce, Jean Maurice himself used to make sure the wiring was right. We used to wire and he used to solder and make sure the flux was the right temperature. And what we did with the 057 clock, with this clock, we used one circuitry with two C cells to illuminate the LED. So the timing of the movement won't ever be affected by changing the batteries for the lighting system. So it's two independent things, and that was never crossed. So we did two different circuits, and I think it's good.
Yeah, that's very smart.
Because you don't want to change the wrong batteries, and we indicate on the back,
right.
These are for the light, this is for the movement.
Yeah. That's very cool.
That's another minute detail that, like, you just, it's so helpful, but you don't think about it until the time when you have to change it, and you're like, oh, now I got to change the time again. Well, now you don't.
Well, you know what? A lot of people don't realize you have to change the clock batteries once a year. You should, as a healthy thing, just like you do with, what do you call it, smoke detectors. But what we want to do is, actually, we've been discussing in our creative department, is to put a chart at the back of the clock. If you ever had a fridge with a filter for water, you know you have to change it every month, or you could have a reminder. So what we're going to do is have a reminder at the back of our battery-operated wall clocks, so you know which month you did change the battery, because you should change it on a yearly basis. But sometimes a battery could last 2 years, but then some digits start to fall out because it doesn't have enough energy. And we do have a low power indicator, but you might as well change it. So we're going to be doing that. That's a little change to wall clocks, but I think it helps people know when they change the battery last. Like, how are you going to remember?
That's really interesting. So Mitchell, what can we expect moving ahead from Marathon? What are you working on now?
What are we working on now?
That has you excited. Anything you can share with us?
You want me to? My team isn't with me to kill me. Okay. You know what I saw today?
What'd you see?
I saw something fantastic.
Okay.
And this is something we've been working for 2 years, but finally we have a prototype sample. I saw it on camera from the factory. It's going to be a new strap system that's coming up, and we're making it completely in Switzerland.
No kidding. Okay.
And the quality of materials that we're using, it's rubber, but it's top-notch surgical rubber, and it's a type of strap system that will allow someone to have, with a large wrist or a small wrist, no matter what size your watch will be, it'll be able to accommodate it with the same strap, but never look too big or too small. It'll always look right. It'll always feel right.
Well, that sounds incredible. We will look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we did a special treatment so it doesn't slip on your wrist. There's a lot of amazing things. And I'm hoping, I think for sure we're going to have production out by the end of the summer.
All right. Excellent. Well, so, you heard it here first. Yeah, we're really excited.
That. How's that?
That's excellent. Yeah. We'll take it.
That's a good one.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I'm going to see if I got any, they're not listening to this. I'm not getting a text saying,
okay,
shut
good.
Up.
Good, yeah, yeah.
Perfect.
Well, Mitchell, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's just been an absolute joy.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun. I'm going to take my dog for a
walk. All right, you do that. And we'll hopefully be able to talk again sometime. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Mitchell.
Thanks for having me. And take care, guys.
All right, you too.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.